This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Hernan Diaz, author of the novel Trust.
Loneliness and solitude is something that has always interested me, you know, in most of the things that I write. That is, to me, maybe not to other readers, it's the thing that I find myself I'm writing about loneliness again. You know, sometimes it's intentional and sometimes it isn't.
We'll be back with Hernan Diaz after these essential words. So this past June marked the 10th anniversary of First Draft. The first episode aired on June 10th, 2013. And if the person I am today told my younger self that I'd be nearly 450 episodes deep into this show in 10 years, I would have laughed at my future self. But alas, here we are. And how did we get here? At what I would estimate is 9,000 hours of work I've put into this podcast. That's reading, researching, interviewing, editing, arranging the guests. I am the entire staff. And I guess the answer is, how did we get to 9,000 hours? Is a mixture of insanity and blind but ferocious dedication to sharing conversations about craft and literature. This isn't AI, folks. This is weekends where I sit and read and so many things in my life that get fully ignored for this endeavor. And I honestly consider it a gift to the world. It's a place where my passion and I hope some amount of finesse and skill marry together to offer this conversation you're about to hear directly to you in the intimate way that audio works. And if you get anything out of this episode or the hundreds that came before, or hopefully the hundreds that will come next, I am asking you in the most honest and authentic way I know how to please support this show. While I love making it and talking to authors and the entire endeavor fills me up, it does not pay the bills. And if we want to support art in this world and conversations about art and lift the curtain up and really talk about how art gets made, well, your support will help keep this show alive. It's here today because of listeners who became supporters. And that's the truth. So I'm asking you to bolster this rich dialogue, this juicy material, with financial support. It's not easy to do, but sticking with this for 10 years wasn't easy to do either. And it's not going to be easy in the future. But if nothing else, it's reliable and consistent. With every episode, I lean into the values of honesty, vulnerability, curiosity, and connection. I think about them as I create this show, and I hope you can feel them in the content. I simply cannot take this time to create First Draft without your support. Please join me on this journey by becoming a donating member to the First Draft community. You can support the show today at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. You can donate on a monthly or annual level. As a thank you to my patrons, you receive access to cuts from the interviews that didn't make it to the final show, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and writing tips from my guests. Again, you can become a supporter by going to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. That's patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Please stay tuned at the end of the interview. I'll offer recommendations on an episode in the archive that is similar to the one you're about to hear. And please rate the show on iTunes and tell everyone you know to subscribe. Thank you for your listening support. And thank you for being here with me today, right here in this moment. And on to the 400-something episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
My interview today is with Hernán Díaz, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel Trust, which was a New York Times bestseller, longlisted for the Booker Prize, and won the Kirkus Prize. His first novel, In the Distance, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the Pen Faulkner Award, and it was the winner of the New American Voices Award, among other distinctions and awards. He is also the author of Borges, Between History and Eternity. His novel Trust includes four competing narratives, all centered around a husband and wife who were stratospherically wealthy during the 1920s in New York City. The husband was a Wall Street tycoon who eternally profited even during the great stock market crash and depression, and whose wife was the daughter of eccentric aristocrats and was determined to forge her own path as a patron of the arts. The four sections of the novel are told in various styles and perspectives, including a fictional novel, diary entries, biography, and memoir. The subjects Trust explores include family, wealth, ambition, capitalism, female autonomy, and isolation. We began the discussion with me asking Hernán Díaz about the fact that he has the same name as a famous Argentinian football player.
That is something that has haunted me for my entire life since I think he was really big in during my teens. And it's not that I'm indifferent to football. I actively hate it and dislike it because, you know, growing up, I mean, I grew up in Sweden. I moved to Argentina like when I was 10 and spent my teens there. And if you're that age and don't play football or soccer, you are immediately ostracized and have a miserable time. And football, like there's no outside of football in Argentina. It's like the weather. It's something you can't leave, like it's there. And it's like a lot, especially, you know, the whole hyper masculine vibes around it, at least at the time. Maybe now it's different, but So every time, even to this day, I utter my name, I have to deal with some sort of joke that people think I haven't heard ever before about there being a football player with my same name.
One of the things you write in your book, it's in the middle, and you say, they say the education of a child begins several generations before it is born. And I never heard that before. And so I wanted to ask you where you thought yours began with your family.
Okay. First, I'd like to frame that quotation and say that I happen to like that quotation. It's a kind of, it comes in a somewhat distorted way from Emerson. And I give it to a despicable character, and it was hard for me to give it to him, but it was also a way for me to be respectful to that character and think that he may have some redeeming qualities, like seeing this passage and being touched by it. Although, of course, he uses it in a way to signal his own privilege, like he doesn't get it at all. He's just really highlighting, you know, his pedigree, which I don't think is the point of that quotation. I don't know. I mean, my family past is a little murky to me. My father was kind of disconnected from his family. My mother has a sort of a family tree. It's, you know, it's a very typical immigrant background. And now I'm referring to my grandparents or great grandparents immigrating into Argentina, you know, at the turn of the century. They could have ended up in New York just as easily. They came from Italy on my maternal side and from Spain on my father's side. My father was actually the first generation. His parents were born in Spain. So Argentina is like a very short blip. If I had to apply that quote to myself, I feel it has to do with books and just being able to engage more deeply and more extensively with a certain tradition that I'm interested in and learning more about it and feeling part of it. You know, I don't mean that in a presumptuous way at all. I just mean this constellation of writers is home and one is in conversation with them. It doesn't mean that one is a worthy interlocutor. It just means that one is addressing that past. So I think that more than any kind of family heritage, which is again a little opaque to me, and that that constellation of writers, more than any kind of institutional education, which I was lucky to have to a very large extent, is what I consider to be my true education. Sort of all the stuff that I've read and keep on reading for pleasure and delight.
Are there a few in the constellations that you could name that were pivotal?
There are really, really so many. I always begin with Borges, because if you are a Borges reader, which I've always been and always will be, I mean, since my teens, that is such a gateway to such a massive map, you know, such a detailed, granular, but also extensive map of literature, of world literature, as we like to say today. So Borges is high up there. I think also, you know, in my teens, I discovered Julio Cortázar, whom I don't reread so much, but he was important back then. And then sort of in my late-ish teens, like 16, 17, I started reading in earnest in English. And for some reason that was really important to me, and guided at first by Borges, you know. So I started reading, I don't know, Hawthorne, Poe, Emerson, sort of very New England-y stuff, you know, Whitman. And then that expanded weirdly also to detective fiction in English, sort of hard-boiled Hammett and Chandler, you know, whom I still love. Then I became very interested in philosophy, which I read for a really long time and studied earnestly in at college and taught for a spell. And then I kept sort of delving into Anglo-American, and I include Irish and Scottish in that canon. I don't know why I was very drawn to that tradition. The 19th century novel, you know, in the US and in the UK is all important to me. And also the turn of the century novel, you know, Henry James, above probably anyone else in that period. I'm also very, very invested in sort of high modernism, and that's something that I've read extensively. Also sort of Latin American modernism and French and German modernism, like that period is and the way in which it challenges form, not just form, that sounds even too modest for that period, sort of in between wars. I think it challenges the very notion of representation in literature. So that is very interesting to me. And then of course there are many contemporary writers who are very important to me. But I would say then, you know, that my home has always been sort of from 19th century modernism, a cluster of contemporary stuff that I like, and this cluster is ever changing, luckily. I mean, I think that's a very healthy thing, and you know, a good portion of philosophy and theory and aesthetics, which is stuff that I'm still quite invested in.
So tell me a little bit about the genesis for Trust. I've seen other interviews with you that you're very interested in the power dynamics around money and the monetary system and things like that. But just curious for you about taking this on and if there was any fear of trying to learn how this all worked.
Oh, yeah. No, fear is sort of a constant color in my emotional palette. It's always there to some extent, for sure. But perhaps the best way to enter into this conversation would be actually to pick a somewhat newer angle, which has to do with solitude, which you seem to be interested in before in our previous question. Or loneliness and solitude is something that has always interested me, you know, in most of the things that I write. That is, to me, maybe not to other readers, but it's the thing that I find myself right. Oh, I'm writing about loneliness again. You know, sometimes it's intentional and sometimes it isn't. But it's perhaps a common denominator, not necessarily the only one, but it is very much there all the time, most of the time. And with trust, it really started from there in a very aware, conscious, and deliberate way. I thought that, sure, I've never been a tycoon myself. It's not an experience that I've had, but I thought that surely if you're colossally wealthy, you must have access to everything you can think of: experiences, places, people, objects. But at the same time, that perhaps must come with a great sense of self-guardedness, of suspicion, of paranoia, of increasing isolation, seclusion, and loneliness. So that to me was a productive dissonance, just to think of the friction between these two experiences. So honestly, that was the genesis. Then came all the ideological aspects, the reflection on economics and power and gender and truth and storytelling and history, and which are totally crucial to the book. It's not, these are not accessories in any way. They're constitutive to the project. But the seed, the genesis, where it all sprung from was this kind of emotional imagining this isolation, that's how it all started.
Because in your book you sort of look at it from four different angles. Your book contains kind of four sections that are told very mm-hmm. differently. One is a novel, one's, you know, a memoir, one is from a diary, one is kind of a personal narrative. And I'm curious if by looking at loneliness, because I would say, you know, in each section, you have lonely characters, mm-hmm. no matter if you're changing who they are. If you came in maybe thinking one thing and came out with any realizations about loneliness?
I think all my realizations are in the book. Like, there isn't anything that I feel compelled to gloss or expand on further. Like, what I learned about loneliness for these four characters is what you may find in the book. And that is the best way that I found to narrate and to convey that, which means that is the best way in which I can express what I learned about the solitude of these four people, narrators, characters. But you are totally right. All of these characters or narrators are profoundly alone, even when they're together. You know, there's in the final section, there is a scene where in the personal diary, it's just a scene that takes two lines, and it's basically, you know, Mildred and Andrew, wife and husband, lying on this hospital bed. You know, they're both fully clothed and they're just holding hands. And Mildred speaks about the solitude à deux, like the being this loneliness, this what would the translation be, like this coupled loneliness in a way, like they're there, they're together, they're holding hands and they're alone, and I feel that kind of reflects their relationship to some extent. In the second book, of course, this man is alone because he's monumental, or he, you know, he pretends to be, he hopes to be, and you know, there's nothing more lonely than being a hero. You know, you are, but essentially alone because you're doing what nobody else can do, and you're doing it for everyone else. This, of course, is an ideological lie, but this is how he represents himself. In the third part, we have this young Italian-American secretary who is very much on purpose in that section in the book, surrounded by men. She doesn't have sort of a friend, a female friend, or anyone she can relate to in that way. And I very much wanted that character to be besieged by these men who want to extract things from her. All of them want something from her. So that's a particular kind of hostile loneliness. And then in the fourth and last part, which I quoted poorly from a moment ago, we have Mildred, who is facing death, which is, of course, the loneliest experience we, all of us, will ever have.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. I noted, I folded down the page in the first section where it's fictionalized, where you have Benjamin, who's the magnate, the tycoon, and he's marrying this woman, Helen. And they're both very singular in how they are in the world. They are loners. And she basically makes a conscious decision to marry him because she could find the solitude that she wanted, which is not usually why you think of people getting married.
Maybe not today. But I think that for a very long time, until just a few decades ago, I think, don't press me for an example because it would take me a beat, but I think we can intuit this, at least in fiction and in novels and in storytelling. Like I think that for centuries, millennia, perhaps this kind of marriage was the only way in which a woman who wanted to be left alone could be left alone, you know, because otherwise, you know, all the social pressures, or, you know, a husband who was exacting, who was demanding, who was abusive, who was, you know, oppressive in any awful way or subtle way that she can think of, was imposed on her, or any other kind of social strictures. So I actually kind of disagree with you. I think that probably a lot of women got married to distant men so that they could be left alone. That doesn't seem implausible at all to me, you know, over the course of our patriarchal history, that seems actually very, very, like a very reasonable proposition, don't you think?
I think if you had a certain social status and wealth, it was probably more possible.
Of course. Oh, doubtless. No, I think for most women, this kind of protected loneliness was an absolute privilege. You know, and it's of course a terrible thing, but. I'm not claiming to have done any serious historical research into this. It's just, it seems to me that it would make sense that that some women of a certain station would marry for exactly that reason, just to be left the hell alone. I can totally see that.
I'm curious how you take, you know, these maybe philosophical ideas and then channel them into story. And like, what is your process to do that?
It's always a very pompous and uncomfortable word to utter, like my philosophical or whatever, you know, theory driven or nonfiction aspects from which I come to the issue of loneliness, regarding how that informs my prose, my fiction. I hope I never write anything to illustrate any kind of conceptual point that I'm trying to make. Like, I'm not that kind of writer. I think some writers do it really well, but I'm not an exemplary writer. I don't write fables of any kind. You know, there isn't like a central point that this whole thing is trying to, in a strict sense of the word, illustrate, as in illuminate by drawing some kind of parable. I think hopefully that all my readings that have affected me in a meaningful and significant and deep way are so constitutive of how I think and talk and approach syntax and approach character and approach story and approach representation that I don't need to, like, it's part of how I think and speak and write. It's not something that I, again, I'm trying to present in a pedagogical way at all. Like, if I think of Adorno, for me is a great philosopher of loneliness for different reasons, and I don't think there's anything as like Adornian necessarily in trust, but the way in which I think about literature has been so influenced by him, like shaped in ways that I would find hard to undo, that whenever I come to a book as a reader or as a writer, like a book that I'm reading or a book that I'm writing, he is there in some way, but I'm not thinking about him. Does this make sense? It's a little bit like, you know, learning a language, you know, and you know you're proficient in that language when you're not thinking, oh, should I use the subjunctive here, or is this the correct preposition? You are just ordering breakfast without giving it further thought. So there's certain readings that are part now of the grammar of my brain, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, it does. And I think part of the challenge, maybe when you have these thoughts and ideas and channeling them into your characters, like you were saying, you know, you were trying to evoke on the page what your characters were experiencing of loneliness, and you mm-hmm. decided to paint them in a certain way. And I think one of the things, you know, so many people who listen to this podcast are writers, that they struggle with is like, I have this idea. I want to envision what it's like to maybe be a woman in a sanitarium in Switzerland. And I want to talk about a female's actual dominance over her husband. But then how do I turn that into a story? How do I turn that into something compelling? And that's where you have to take away anything that might be didactic and turn it into story. And I just, your ideas are so complex and high-minded. And how do you do that?
Well, I don't think I start with, maybe I start with the ideas to some extent, like the more disembodied ideas, to call them somehow, because I'm loath to call them like philosophical ideas or conceptual, points or whatever. So let's call them sort of these disembodied ideas, for lack of a better. I'll come up with something better as soon as we wrap this up. Don't worry. And maybe there is an element of that, but I would like to stress a couple of things. The first thing is emotion. I read to feel things, and I write to feel things and hopefully convey to readers the things that I'm feeling as I'm writing. That is probably number one, tied with a sense of formal rigor. Like, emotion alone, I'm not interested in that, in like a scream on the page. That's very unappealing to me. Equally unappealing is some kind of heartless, formal engineering experiment. Like, that leaves me literally cold. So that's the first thing for me, like to try to find the emotional aspect of whatever it is that I'm writing, but also try to do it as beautifully as I can. These two things are paramount. There's nothing more important than those two. Not even story trumps that into my mind. Like, there are so many things that I read that, you know, aren't diegetic or plot driven, and but they have these things, and that's enough for me. That's all I need. If in addition to that, you know, you are telling a story, because I like to be told stories as well, but again, it's not that is the first thing for me. I think everything has to be in service of this kind of first dyad that I mentioned of emotion and formal rigor, and the story for me happens in language. Like, I'm not like a Platonic writer. By which I mean that I don't have like an ideal story that is floating in some kind of essential ether that then is manifested and incarnated in a more or less contingent form on the page. For me, the story really grows sentence by sentence. I'm a writer of sentences. I'm not a writer of stories, which I think is a distinction that I hope to remember, because I'm going to use that some other time. if that makes any sense, like, I just said it off the cuff, and I feel that makes a ton of sense to describe what my process is. And of course, this, you know, as I write, I think, oh, you know, ultimately I want this scene or this chapter or even the whole book, if I'm lucky, you know, to go to this point. And there will be a million detours along the way, but I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but I don't draft. I don't, you know, because again, I'm writing sentence by sentence, and I'm editing all my sentences as I go along. So when I'm done, I'm done. And I keep editing like a crazy person forever, but it's not that then I go on to draft two. There's no draft two.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. When I was reading this book, I was thinking, you know, it's so unique because you have these four parts in there. It's almost like a deconstruction of itself, but it also is building at the same time. I found my reading experience to be both sort of collapsing and expanding at the same time. And I thought, I don't think AI could write this.
I have not, like AI comes up all the time now because I understand it's. I can't explain to you, Mitzi, the extent to which I know nothing about this. So I don't even know. But thank you.
You're a real person.
Oh, of course not.
Is there anything you want to say about the book? I know we didn't get deep into the plot or anything. We were kind of talking up
Oh
here,
no,
but is
this is
there?
lovely. I feel like I've been talking about the book for so long, and this has been really refreshing. You managed to make me say things that I hadn't said before. So that's fun for me, even if it is erratic for everyone else.
Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influences you as a writer?
I can. I'm for once in my life, I'm prepared for this because I was told that this would happen to me. So I am ready. So I have this up here. So this is one of, I'm going to read a whole short story, which is one of my favorite texts in the history of texts. And it's just one sentence long. And it is written by Franz Kafka. And it is called The Wish to Be a Red Indian, which is, needless to say, a very problematic translation by Willa and Edwin Muir. I don't read German, but I looked this up, and red has been added to the title, which absolves Kafka from that, the responsibility of that word. So, shall I destroy this by reading it hesitantly and stutteringly? Okay. Again, keep in mind, this is just one sentence, and it's the whole story. If one were only an Indian, instantly alert and on a racing horse, leaning against the wind, kept on quivering jerkily over the quivering ground until one shed one's spurs, for there needed no spurs, threw away the reins, for there needed no reins, and hardly saw that the land before one was smoothly shorn heath when horse's neck and head would be already gone. And that's it. That's the whole story. And I love it so much.
Wow. Do you want to say anything else about it?
Well, I have so many things to say. I mean, the first one is sort of this beautiful interplay between compression and expansion in the single sentence. But I mean, by compression, I mean syntactical compression. You know, it's a very, very tight sentence. It's one lonely sentence. And by expansion, I mean that it is describing a vast expanse, you know, the sort of this boundless territory, and also this metaphysical expansion, you know, this merger of the writer with the landscape. So again, compression and expansion managed so beautifully. And then there is something beautiful. There is, you know, again, talking about syntax and even the morphology of the grammar of the passage. You know, if one, so we start in this in an impersonal kind of world, but then, you know, immediately that one seems to be negated by that subjunctive. If one were only an Indian, and that longing, like there has to be a subject, there has to be a person behind that longing. But then there is a whole there's a whole arc, you know, from that longing to the impersonality of the end, you know. And I also, you know, I don't, again, I don't read German, but the use of not conjugated verbs in this passage is so beautifully and kind of unmoors it from time, you know, is that is so lovely. And And just this single sentence, you know, narrating this trajectory into sort of a vanishing point, almost as understood in perspective, you know, this point where parallel lines to our eyes converge, you know, so it's essentially an impossible point. And there is this velocity, you know, this just writing becoming in the end, speed becoming in the end stasis and motionlessness, because the writer has merged with the landscape. So velocity is almost canceled out. So there is this, again, compression, expansion, velocity, and stasis, and self, and impersonality. It's just so immensely beautiful and moving and elegant to me. Hope that makes sense and that somebody else finds something in it.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was extra hard or changed from the first draft or something you liked.
Yeah. Well, again, no drafts for me, but let's read the first section, the novel within the novel. Morning brought out a deeper sort of white from the changeless snows, capping the peaks on either side of the valley, which later in the midday sun would become blinding splinters. A pastoral bell echoed across the sky, dappled with flocks of small solid clouds, while unseen birds found themselves yet again unable to break their bondage to their two or four notes. The air was laced with the scent of water, stone, and the long dead things that darkly were finding their way back to life deep under the dew-soaked dirt. During that unpopulated hour, the buildings ceased to be objects of artifice and industry to reveal the nature fossilized in them and come forth in their mineral presence. The breeze dissolved in stiller air. The treetops, so green they were black against the blue, stopped swaying. And for a moment, there was no struggle, and all was rest, because time seemed to have arrived at its destination. Then a nurse with a compress, an orderly with a rake, a doctor with a clipboard, a server with an infusion would set it all in motion again. The itching, the exhaustion, the words, the thoughts behind them, and the noise of her being, so much louder than the world.
Do you want to share why you chose that one?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I promise to you, this is not intentional, but gosh, there is like a parallel between this and the Kafka thing. And I know that sounds impossibly vain. I mean, I'm just saying, I notice, I'm not talking about quality or anything. I'm just saying I notice Kafka's influence here too, because we have a similar interplay of this impersonality, you know, of just being absorbed by the landscape. You know, we have the landscape and the gazer, the viewer of the landscape seem to be merged in the first paragraph, right? And then in the second one, we see the sort of the world rushing back in, and there is a person with her thoughts that are louder than the world that was just described in the previous paragraph. So it's, in a way, it's the reverse of the reverse trajectory. And again, this is totally unplanned. Like, it's happening by juxtaposing these two texts. This goes from impersonality to selfhood in a way. And it's also, it's sort of this lyrical passage in a book that doesn't normally have this tone. You know, it's very much and very intentionally sort of encrusted in that point of the novel. And I wanted to achieve a tone that is unique to that paragraph. It's like a flight of, it's a rhetorical flight that none of the narrators allow themselves ever in that book. And I actually wrote that trying to come out of a moment when I was really, really, really profoundly stuck with the novel, stuck in that unpleasant way that is life-threatening, and you think it's over for me. And I try to get out of myself and out of the book. And I wrote this, and I found, again, here's the sort of the writer of sentences rather than the person who has an overarching plan. I found that this worked well in that setting. And it also does, this passage ends up doing a lot of things and is referenced in covert ways in other parts of the book too. So it ended up being a very, very important passage, although it was born out of a sense of despair.
Where do you write?
Where I can. I live in a very small apartment in Brooklyn, as you know from the beginning, and I was just being texted by my child, who was ejected from her own room to do this interview with you, and now she wants back in. I write a lot at libraries, and a bunch at cafes with stupid, enormous noise canceling headphones, because baristas love their playlists.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I listen to music a lot to get away. I don't ever want to get away from writing. Like, if I'm not writing, it's because I'm stuck, as I told you, or I'm working on something else. Like I'm on book tour, or I'm editing the journal that I edit as my quote unquote day job, or I'm being a parent, or I'm dealing with like the tedious stuff that makes up daily life. But I'm never trying to get away from writing. I'm trying to, that's what I would ideally want to be doing all the time if I were left alone to do it, and if I were inspired enough to do it all the time.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
My wife. And she is, she's brilliant. She is a filmmaker. So she comes to storytelling from a totally different point of view. And she is a massive influence in my work. And I end up taking most of her notes, actually.
How have you dealt with rejection?
It almost drove me crazy to, I'm not using the word lightly at all. For well over a decade, everything that I wrote was rejected universally. Like everything, not part of it, everything that I wrote. It made me feel insane. It made me wonder if I was actually like doodling on the page rather than writing actual words. So, and you know, I was very angry, and I was very like not understanding, like this is all I wanted to do, but I was told to please stop by the world. And that was a complicated thing to negotiate for myself and to keep going without becoming like a solipsistic crazy person, you know, or, you know, and so to muster, and this perhaps will resonate with some of the writers who are going through similar experiences, because I think it is part of being a writer, and unless you're immensely lucky and people like publish your stuff, you know, when you're 21, and then you have this continuous, you know, stream of publications. It's not at all my experience. What I was going to say is that the hard thing is to persevere in to not doubt your love for what you're doing, you know, despite of the reaction you're getting from the world. That is a very hard thing, but it is that love that will hopefully make you stay with it. You know, you don't. I know that was the case for me. Like nobody again would touch my stuff, and I kept doing it because I loved being in language. It wasn't about, you know, being, I mean, it was being published in the sense that it's a nice moment of validation and to be part of a dialogue with other writers and to be heard, you know, it's important. I'm not dismissing it for one second, but at the end of the day, behind the anger, behind the frustration, behind the immense feeling of solitude, there was the love of inhabiting language.
And what is your favorite word?
Milk.
Thank you so much for your time. I'm so appreciative.
Thank you, Mitzi. I'm very grateful. This was great fun.
If you like today's show with Hernan Diaz, author of the novel Trust, check out my interview with Matthew Thomas on his novel, We Are Not Ourselves. We talked about finding the title, how we can evolve as humans, the decisions he made about point of view characters, and writing about American women in the second half of the 20th century. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 415 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Jennifer Groats, Buzzy Jackson, and David Vandenberg. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.